This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 860 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip 125 days into the fraudulent ceasefire. According to the Ministry of Health in Gaza, at least 586 Palestinians have been killed since October 10th, and more than 1,500 have been injured. On Tuesday, at least 7 Palestinians were killed in separate attacks in central and northern Gaza. Al-Aqsa Radio reported that an Israeli airstrike targeted a motorcycle in central Gaza, killing 3 Palestinians, and that at least half a dozen airstrikes were reported in southern Rafah. On Monday, February 9th, at least 4 Palestinians were killed and others were injured when Israel bombed a residential apartment in the Nasser neighborhood west of Gaza City. At Al-Shifa Hospital, reporter Nahed Hajjaj filmed people grieving over their loved ones killed in the attack. Al Jazeera's Ibrahim Al-Khalili told the network on Monday that the attack on the apartment building was, quote, another deadly escalation carried out by the Israeli military. He said that the building had already been targeted and partially damaged during the genocide, and that, quote, the renewed attack left dozens injured and they were transported to a hospital. Al-Nasser is a very crowded neighborhood, he added. People took refuge in this neighborhood and took refuge in that partially damaged residential building. They were forced to live there because of the scarcity of shelters. Also on Monday, the Wafa news agency reported that Israeli forces shot and killed a farmer, Khaled Baraka, east of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. On February 6th, Israeli forces carried out a series of strikes in Gaza City and Khan Yunis, killing at least 6 Palestinians. Reporter Hemes Al-Rafi filmed an attack in the Zeytoun neighborhood of Gaza City on a building that was one of several in which residents were ordered by the Israeli military to leave. Journalist Mohammed Al-Saifi filmed another angle of the attack on the building. On February 3rd and 4th, at least 27 Palestinians were killed and dozens were wounded in a series of attacks, including strikes on the Tufah neighborhood of Gaza City and on tents in the Mawasi camp for forcibly displaced families in southern Gaza. 2 infants, a 5-month-old and a 10-day-old newborn, were killed in so-called double-tap attacks in al-Mawasi, as well as Hassan Hussein al-Samiri, a paramedic with the Palestine Red Crescent Society, who was killed as he rescued and evacuated the wounded. Journalist Ahmed al-Najjar, who is a recent guest on this live stream, stated on social media that 2 sisters, Rafah and Rimas Abu Jameh, were also murdered in the double-tap strike on tents, ostensibly during a so-called ceasefire. Reporter Ahmed Sabah recorded footage of Palestinians mourning over some of the 14 bodies of their loved ones killed in Gaza City. Israel killed a toddler early in the morning on February 2nd. Local reports say that 3-year-old Iyad Ahmed Al-Rabaya was killed after Israeli naval boats shelled tents sheltering displaced families in the al-Mawasi area west of Khan Yunis. These massacres, escalating in intensity, followed a series of attacks on January 31st. Reporter Mazen Brim captured footage of some of the Israeli airstrikes by drones and fighter jets on the Mawasi Khan Yunis displacement tent camp. Approximately 30 Palestinians were killed and nearly 70 were injured in attacks that day. Researcher Maha Husseini stated that 7 people were killed in an Israeli strike on a tent belonging to the Abu Hadid family in the al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunis, and 8 were killed in central and western Gaza City. An attack on a police station northwest of Gaza killed 14. Photographer Yusuf Al-Zanoun of Active Stills captured images of Palestinians inspecting the site of the attack in Gaza City's Sheikh Radwan neighborhood, while bodies piled up inside Al-Shifa Hospital. On Tuesday, the Gaza government media office assessed the scale of Israel's attacks 4 months after the signing of the so-called ceasefire agreement, as well as Israel's deliberate failure with absolute impunity to meet its humanitarian aid obligations. According to the media office, as of February 10th, Israel has violated the agreement 1,620 times, with nearly 600 shooting incidents, 80 incursions, 750 shelling and targeting incidents, and 230 demolitions of homes and buildings. Humanitarian aid trucks are trickling in, but at only 43% of the expected compliance rate. And that 43% is higher than the number of fuel trucks, of which only 14% of the expected volume has entered Gaza. The media office said that the Israeli occupation has also failed to allow the entry of materials necessary for infrastructure maintenance and repairs. It has not allowed the entry of heavy equipment for the civil defense to remove rubble and recover bodies. It has not allowed the entry of medical and health equipment, supplies, and medicines. It has not allowed the entry of a sufficient supply of tents, mobile homes, and shelter materials. It has not allowed the operation of the power plant, and it has not adhered to the yellow line and has rather encroached further across the Gaza Strip. On February 4th, Israel sent back to Gaza the bodies of 54 Palestinians, as well as 66 boxes containing unidentified human remains. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza stated that its medical teams were handling the bodies and preparing to collect any relevant identifying information in order to give them to any remaining family members. Dr. Munir Al-Bersh, the Director General of the Gaza Health Ministry, stated that, quote, "Today we stand before closed boxes, searching inside for the features of our sons and daughters. In the absence of forensic tools, no DNA testing, and not even the minimum medical and forensic capabilities that would enable us to identify or document them as befits a human being. How can we restore names to bodies that have been reduced to numbers on bags and boxes? How can families receive their sons and daughters when their features are erased, their bones shattered, and their bodies violated even after death?" Dr. Al-Bersh added, quote, "We are not asking for the impossible, nor demanding a privilege. We are demanding a basic right, that a human being be returned as a human being, that their body be preserved, that their identity be protected, and that their bodies be returned to their families with dignity, not in coffins, not as fragments, not as mere numbers. When the world remains silent in the face of the scene, Gaza is not the only victim, but silence becomes complicity in the crime." Quote, "The medical system in the Gaza Strip has collapsed at every stage of care," says our contributor Asim Al-Nabih, who reported on the situation of Gaza's health sector this week for Al Arabi TV. He stated on social media this week that, quote, "From the moment a wounded person is evacuated from the site of an attack, the failure is already underway due to the crippling of ambulance services and Israel's restriction on fuel supplies. The collapse deepens with severe shortages of medicines, medical consumables, follow-up care, and life-saving treatments, all caused by tight controls by Israel on the entry of medical equipment and supplies. This is compounded by the widespread destruction of health facilities, the lack of sufficient medical staff, and the absence of diagnostic and surgical equipment, laboratory materials, and other essential resources," Asim Al-Nabih said. 46% of essential medications are out of stock, 66% of medical supplies are out of stock, and 84% of laboratory and blood bank supplies are depleted, according to the Ministry of Health. The catastrophic effects of this health annihilation, the ministry added, have made the continuation of healthcare a daily miracle and a major challenge to recovery efforts and the restoration of many specialized services. With that as the health system's baseline, deliberately destroyed by Israel during the last 28 months of genocide, bacterial meningitis cases are now spreading quickly across Gaza, particularly threatening the lives of children. Health officials said at least 15 cases have been recorded so far, with expectations that the outbreak will worsen given the dire medical and living conditions faced by the majority of the population, reported Tarek Hajjaj on February 4th for Mondo Weiss. Hajjaj spoke to Dr. Ahmed Al-Fara, director of pediatrics at the Nasser Medical Complex, who said that the disease itself is not new, but what is alarming about the current wave is that all recorded cases so far are bacterial, which require immediate antibiotic treatments or risk serious complications, including hearing loss, vision loss, paralysis, brain damage, and even death. The health ministry stated last week that approximately 11,000 cancer patients are being deprived by Israel of specialized and diagnostic treatment, both inside and outside Gaza. The lack of early diagnosis and follow-up equipment, such as MRI and mammography machines, the closure of specialized hospitals, and the destruction of the Gaza Cancer Center have exacerbated the suffering of patients. Resources for providing care to cancer patients have been destroyed and depleted, most importantly, chemotherapy drugs and diagnostic equipment, the ministry said. 64% of cancer medications are completely out of stock, and 4,000 patients with referrals for treatment abroad have been waiting for more than 2 years for the crossing to open and their travel to be facilitated, the ministry added. The partial opening this week of the Rafah crossing at the Egyptian border, which has been closed since May 2024, has given many families hope that they or their loved ones could travel for medical treatment. However, only a handful of patients have been permitted to leave by Israel. Doctors say that the list of 50 patients a day slated for evacuation has been cut to as few as 5. This medical death sentence policy carried out by Israel killed 7-year-old Anwar Al-Ashi, who died of kidney failure this week waiting for medical evacuation. The Gaza government media office said that the compliance rate of Israel's approved permits to cross into Egypt was only around 25%. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israel's security cabinet this week approved measures that consolidate and deepen its control and make it even easier for Jewish Israeli settlers to steal Palestinian land, though there were few restrictions on land theft to begin with for nearly a century now. Stating the obvious, Israeli Defense Minister and war crimes fugitive Israel Katz said that, quote, "We are anchoring settlement as an inseparable part of Israel's government policy." The Hamas political party responded that Israel's decision, quote, "falls within the framework of the fascist settlement approach, the comprehensive annexation plan, and the war of extermination and ethnic cleansing adopted by the extremist criminal occupation government. This aims to impose a false sovereignty and alter the geographical and legal realities on the ground," the Hamas political party added. Meanwhile, a 5-year-old boy with cancer, who was born in Gaza but has been in Ramallah for treatment since 2022, was essentially handed a death sentence by a Jerusalem District Court judge, Ram Winograd, this week. The judge dismissed a petition filed by the human rights group Gisha to grant the boy entry across the Green Line to receive treatment at a hospital in Tel Aviv. Gisha says that, quote, "the decision was made despite the severity of the boy's condition and an expert opinion by an Israeli physician recommending treatment available to him nearby and warning of the risks in transferring him abroad for treatment." because the appropriate medical care has been made unavailable in Gaza due to the siege that was in place for 17 years before the genocide began, and now, as we just reported a few minutes ago, as cancer treatments are completely unavailable 2 years into the genocide, the boy has been receiving care in the West Bank. After treatment options in the West Bank were exhausted, his doctors determined that he now urgently requires antibody immunotherapy, treatment which is not available in the West Bank, followed by a bone marrow transplant. Despite the danger to his life, the court chose not to intervene in the state's decision denying him access. In doing so, it effectively reaffirmed the state's sweeping policy barring residents of Gaza from entering Israel since the outbreak of the war, in contrast to the practice that had been in place prior to October 2023, Gisha explained. The rights group has been engaged in legal proceedings regarding the boy's case since November 2025. In its most recent response to the court, submitted only after severe delays and the filing of a contempt of court motion, the state claimed that the Minister of Defense himself, Israel Katz, decided not to allow the child's passage on the grounds that Gaza residents are barred from entering Israel for any purpose whatsoever. The state also attempted to shift responsibility onto the child's family, arguing that no effort had been demonstrated to find a third country where the child could receive treatment via the Allenby crossing to Jordan, despite the position of the child's physicians that such a journey could endanger his life, while the necessary treatment is available a short drive away. In his ruling, Judge Winograd accepted the state's arguments in full. Among other things, he was determined that there was insufficient evidence presented to establish that the child's medical condition prevented his transfer to Jordan, that no attempts had been made to locate appropriate treatment for him there, and that there is no justification for judicial intervention in the decision of the Minister of Defense. He further noted that a principled petition challenging the sweeping policy barring patients from Gaza from receiving treatment in Israel or the West Bank is pending before the High Court. Accordingly, he refrained from granting individual remedy and, in effect, upheld the state's decision to abandon the child to his death, Gisha noted. And in the Dehesha refugee camp south of Bethlehem, Khaled Al-Saifi, a beloved community leader, died this week after being medically neglected in an Israeli prison for 4 months. I knew Khaled Al-Saifi, or as he was called, Teacher Khaled, personally. He was the co-founder of the Ibda Cultural Center inside the camp, a place I used to work and live while reporting for KPFA and the Electronic Intifada and other outlets beginning in the early 2000s. Teacher Khaled was released from an Israeli prison where he was medically neglected and in deteriorating health. He was released in critical condition to an intensive care unit as he was unable to walk and suffered from severe pulmonary fibrosis after being denied adequate health care and medication while in detention. He died just 1 week after his release from prison. Khaled Al-Saifi was 67 years old. We send our sincere condolences to the Al-Saifi family and all of the children he taught and mentored over 30 years of Ibda's work in Dehesha refugee camp. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight The Toxic Legacy of Genocide by Islam El-Habil, an engineer from Gaza writing from Malaysia. Before the genocidal war, daily life in Gaza included an informal but functional plastic collection system. A waste collector moved through the neighborhoods using a donkey-drawn cart, calling for residents to sell plastic and scrap materials. This activity was not only a source of income, but also an integral part of local solid waste management practices. Households commonly separated plastic waste at the source, sorting larger plastic items such as cups, plates, toys, and plastic appliances. These materials were stored and later collected by the waste collector, who transported them from one street to another. The process provided livelihood support while simultaneously contributing to the environmental protection by reducing plastic accumulation in public spaces. It created income-generating opportunities by reducing plastic accumulation in streets and directing part of the waste into limited recycling pathways, depending on available facilities and technical capacity, thereby supporting basic environmental protection and public health under blockade conditions. Following the genocide that began in October 2023, the system collapsed, leaving plastic waste uncollected and accumulating in the environment, where it increasingly releases pollutants into air, water, and human bodies. The destruction caused by Israel extends beyond physical infrastructure. It disrupts established material management systems and reshapes the relationship between society and waste, resulting in a highly polluted environment with limited or no alternatives for mitigation, generating global consequences that extend beyond Gaza and pose broader environmental risks to the surrounding region. After Israel cut off fuel and electricity supplies on October 9, 2023, fuel has become largely inaccessible, forcing thousands of Palestinians to confront an urgent and ongoing energy shortage. As the destruction continued over months and available firewood, including salvaged doors and household materials, was progressively depleted, displaced families increasingly resorted to emergency alternatives, the most hazardous of which was burning plastic for cooking and heating. The conversion of plastic into fuel, as it is sporadically and dangerously done in Gaza under the duress of the Israeli blockade and genocide, involves a sequential process that begins with collecting plastic from different locations and sorting it by type, a task made extremely difficult under conditions of war and severe resource scarcity. Alarmingly, and far more commonly, plastic burning occurs both in improvised clay ovens and poorly ventilated, confined spaces, and as direct open burning inside displacement camps, where residents are forced to burn plastic, paper, and similar waste. In both cases, the plastic can provide fuel for cooking and warmth. This forced practice poses significant health risks, particularly to women and children, as women are typically responsible for cooking near these ovens while children remain in close proximity. Burning plastic releases dense smoke and toxic emissions inside tents, contributing to a rise in respiratory diseases, most notably asthma and pulmonary infections, especially among children, elderly people, and women. Children represent the most vulnerable group within this exposure pathway. They grow up in environments saturated with burned plastic residues, play near plastic waste, and consume food and water stored in containers reused repeatedly under unsafe conditions. Their developing bodies are subjected to chronic exposure to pollutants at a time when laboratory facilities, environmental monitoring systems, and medical treatment capacities have been severely damaged or rendered inaccessible. In this context, plastic pollution becomes biologically embedded through prolonged exposure. Genocide, then, effectively functions as an uncontrolled system for the production and accumulation of plastic-related contamination. Even after the cessation of hostilities, plastic-derived pollutants are expected to persist in soil, groundwater, and the food chain, continuing to affect human beings, human health, long after physical reconstruction begins. Discussing the reconstruction of Gaza without addressing plastic contamination therefore neglects a critical environmental and public health dimension. Debris management is not solely an engineering challenge, but a chemical and environmental one that requires structured strategies for plastic waste treatment and remediation. Without such interventions, reconstruction efforts risk reestablishing communities on contaminated land, embedding the toxic legacy of war into the rebuilt environment. Those are excerpts from The Toxic Legacy of Genocide by Islam Al-Habil, an engineer from Gaza and a Malaysia-based microplastics specialist, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. Pharmacist, writer, and tailor Omar Hamad has been posting through the genocide about his attempts to salvage and protect books from the explosions, attacks, and destruction of homes. This week, Omar and his friends began rebuilding an entire library from scratch, including purchasing and self-printing around 700 books. Quote, "I carried them on my back and didn't feel their weight at all. I was incredibly happy with this accomplishment," he wrote. Quote, "These books range from Islamic works on jurisprudence, creed, the prophetic biography, Quran, exegesis, and Islamic history. They also include Arabic language books and a complete encyclopedia of poetry covering Arab poets, as well as a small number of novels. As we have said, and our slogan will always remain, sometimes building a library is an act of freedom," he wrote. This week, Omar and his colleagues opened the Phoenix Library. He says that the Phoenix Library, quote, "is not only the first library to be built during the genocide in Gaza, it is the result of ideas that accumulated to reshape the very concept of a library in Gaza and to strengthen the culture of reading from which we were deprived during 2 years of educational genocide. Despite all circumstances being against us, with the rising costs of basic construction materials and the soaring prices of books and paper, we defied all odds." You can find out much more about Omar's work and the new Phoenix Library in Gaza by going to his Instagram, omar.hamad7. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.